Hello, and welcome to the Mirrorbox Films podcast. We are a movie production company and online community built around genre films that reflect humanity. I'm Sonya May, writer, editor, director of content marketing for Mirrorbox Films.
And I am Hudson Phillips. I am a writer, producer, and founder of Mirrorbox Films. This week, we've got a new Study Up episode for you where Alex Oakley and Monica Beard go out every month and explore some new area of creativity and report back to us. So, Sonya, what area of creativity are they exploring this week?
This week, they walk us through supporting characters and what roles they play in film and literature. Hint, hint, they are important.
They are important. This is a great episode. Had a lot of fun listening to Alex and Monica deep dive into the subject of supporting characters, and here they are.
There are no small parts, only small actors. Konstantin Stanislavski. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Mirrorbox Films Study Up Podcast. I am your host, Alex Oakley.
And I am your host, Monica Beard.
And we are here today. Oh, man.
I don't sound that weak, do I?
You sound pretty weak, dear.
So, quick backstory before we get started.
I don't know if Hudson's going to approve of this part.
No, he'll love it.
Okay, all right, go for it.
It's our quirk.
It's your quirk. Don't rope me into this.
Whatever. Anyway, if I do sound incredibly weak, it is because I am terribly sick. I'm not terribly sick. It's because I drank during the day, and then I got too drunk during the day, and then I took a 2-hour nap and woke up hungover, and it's still the same day. Bear with me as I work through what's happening to myself.
But that's okay, because that's why I'm here to keep us on track.
Luckily, Alex did most of the research, so I'll be here mostly humming and hawing.
You know, we all need a hum-har.
Yeah.
You can be my supporting character in this podcast.
Oh, well, that's funny you should mention that, Alex.
Oh, is it funny that I should mention that?
Yeah, because... Well, because our topic today is supporting characters.
Oh, crazy.
What?
That's right. To go along with the...
We never know what's happening before we just meet up and start.
And just start talking. But for the month of June, the theme here at Mirrorbox is, of course, character. So we're going to talk about the most important characters to your narrative. The supporting ones.
They're the most important?
Yes, they are, Monica.
No kidding.
No kidding indeed. Unless you're doing a one-man show, and then in which case, on your own. So supporting characters are defined as the characters in a narrative that are not the primary focus of the narrative. So that literally means anybody who is not a protagonist is a supporting character.
Even if they seem to have a big role, they're still not.
Even if they have a big role, so long as they are not the main character.
Sure.
They are still going to be a supporting character. The goal of a supporting character, the purpose of a supporting character, is to give depth to the protagonist, the world the protagonist inhabits, and the conflict facing the protagonist. So any character who is there that is not the focus of our narrative, that is not going through that hero's journey, that is not moving along through this character arc, is going to be a supporting character. Now, that's not to say supporting characters can't have depth and can't have their own character arcs and can't have background, but it is to say that they are there for a purpose, and that purpose is to further the main character in some way.
I think that's an interesting point to make clear, is that supporting characters are meant to serve a kind of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, why have them? Even if you have them mostly as set dressing.
Yeah.
So to speak.
They can absolutely be as simple to the plot as set dressing. You're exactly right. But I've got here sort of a top tips for making the most convincing supporting characters possible for your narrative, for your movie, for whatever you happen to be working on at the time.
Oh, please, regale me.
I will be more than happy to regale you, Monica. So we're going to separate our supporting characters into two categories, and I'm going to borrow some terms from ancient Greek theater and sort of recombine them into new meaning. So first, we've got our deuteragonists. Deuteragonist originally referred to the second most important actor in a Greek theater troupe. He would always come on second, and he would always usually be the sort of sidekick to whatever the main character was. So I'm going to redefine this term, and in our conversation, deuteragonist is going to refer to any supporting character that still has a substantial amount of screen time, is often far more, has far more character development and depth than most other characters in the show, and is still very, very important and very, very prominent in the narrative. And then I'm going to further divide deuteragonist into a couple more subcategories to give you a more basic idea of what you can look for when you're creating your supporting characters. Please. And then the other category is triagonists, and triagonist, also borrowed from Greek theater, refers to the third most important actor in a Greek theater company. After the top three actors, everybody else is just chorus. So triagonist in this really means minor characters, characters who don't have that much screen time, characters who have effect on one aspect of the plot, are potentially tied to a specific location, or even bit parts or under fivers, characters with five or less lines, maybe 30 seconds of screen time, who may not even get to interact with the protagonist at any point, but they might not. So triagonists are definitely going to be less developed, but that doesn't mean they are any less important than the deuteragonist or the protagonist.
They're just important for different reasons.
Exactly.
Ah.
So let's start with those deuteragonists. So I've got deuteragonists here separated into five main categories. Now, there may be some exceptions. There may be some ancillary things that I didn't think about. But my research has pointed me towards five main categories. The first is the most obvious, the antagonist. Oftentimes, if you have a protagonist, you're gonna have an antagonist. A great example.
A good example
of an outstanding antagonist that really stands out as a fleshed out character, maybe not with much backstory, but with a lot of development and a lot of interest, is Heath Ledger's Joker in The Dark Knight. I mean, it won an Oscar posthumously, and it was a fantastic performance that everybody still talks about today.
Sure.
You know, that kind of thing. The next category is quite simply the best friend category. The best friend is the character that is on the same level as the protagonist, or at least in the same social sphere or same setting as the protagonist. They often know the same amount, maybe sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, but they serve as sort of an ally to the protagonist.
The Mercutio.
Yeah, a Mercutio to the Romeo. Good example, very good example. So other examples include someone like Rupert Grint and Emma Watson playing Ron and Hermione in Harry Potter. They're both students with Harry Potter, and they serve as sort of his allies in their various travails and conflicts and whatnot.
Of course.
Of course, yes.
I say as though I've seen Harry Potter.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm not going to get into that.
Cause for contention.
It's Harry Potter. It's a boy wizard. That's the important part. If you know that, you're good, right? The next category is sidekick. Now, the sidekick is sort of going to take almost a subservient role to the protagonist. Now, this isn't always as cut and dry as Batman and Robin, but that is a good example of a sidekick supporting character. But at the same time, another good example is actually a set of best friends in the form of John Watson to Sherlock Holmes. While John Watson is Sherlock's best friend, he still sort of serves as a subservient role to Sherlock Holmes, at least intellectually. Even though he still operates as an ally, he is there for Sherlock Holmes to explain the plot to.
The Jar Jar Binks.
I would not go so far as to call Jar Jar Binks a sidekick. And I demand you take that back.
It's out in the world now.
Jar Jar Binks is a protagonist, and you cannot convince me otherwise.
Jar Jar Binks is an antagonist because he's a Sith Lord. I'm sorry.
Moving on. The next category is often a much maligned category, but it's still important to the narrative oftentimes, and that is the love interest. Of course, the love interest is the flame, however variety that comes into the protagonist. It's, you know, their ex wife that they are trying to fall back in love with. It's the...
Ocean's 11.
Yeah, Ocean's 11. It's the girlfriend that they've got kids with. It's the girl that they saw in the subway. A really good example of a standout love interest who plays a large role in the story and is still, like, an interesting character is Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Ramona Flowers in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Very unique, very standout love interest. And then the fifth category that I've kind of outlined here is sort of the, I'm calling it the opposite to the sidekick role, but you know, that's iffy, but it's the mentor role. So the mentor or the sensei, whatever you want to call it, is a character that is there to serve as the sort of the protector, the teacher, the educator of the main character. Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid.
The Obi-Wan.
Yeah, the Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars. The Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. I could go on and on and on. There's so many examples of mentor characters. But so those five, with a couple exceptions, are our main categories of deuteragonists, our main categories of complex backstoried characters. Now, not every narrative is going to have one of these. Like, for instance, Men in Black doesn't have a love interest. If we focus on, like, Will Smith as the main character, it doesn't have a love interest character, but it does have an antagonist and it has a mentor. And then one could even argue that the pug operates as a sidekick. You know, so movies, they use deuteragonists as necessary to further that main character. And Men in Black just didn't need a love interest to accomplish what it wanted to accomplish. And so the important thing, the sort of the things that you need to keep in mind when you are writing your supporting characters, when you're directing your supporting characters, and when you're casting your supporting characters is, one, you want to involve them in the world. These deuteragonists need to be part of the world that they are in. Or if they're, you know, for whatever reason from without the world, such as like E.T. or something, they need to be part of that world, and then they need to be alien to the world they are in. That needs to be part of them.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think, I don't know if we've discussed it on this podcast before, but I know we've discussed it on ours, is that part of developing a character arc for, say, a main character, your protagonist, is establishing what is normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think side characters are a really, really easy way to establish what is normal or what is expected. And then if you have a main character who, you know, goes against that or is somehow doesn't fit into that image, it can help to exemplify, like, why your main character is different or how your main character changes from the beginning, from, say, fitting into whatever is normal into the world versus towards the end where they no longer fit into that or they've grown past that or, you know, etc.
Sure, yeah. That's a really, really good point. These supporting characters can definitely help establish the world that your character inhabits and then, you know, help emphasize how they change. In addition to that, they must have a purpose within the larger narrative. Now, the purpose could be, like Monica said, showing the norm to show where your protagonist is going to, how they're going to change, how they're going to become uncomfortable with their norm. Mm-hmm. Or it could be to start a conflict, start a secondary conflict. I mean, even best friend characters often have fights with the protagonist in order to create more dramatic tension in the narrative.
I have a question for you.
I have an answer, hopefully.
Do you have a favorite side character that you think really helped with the main character's story arc?
Ooh, a favorite side character. I'll tell you what, I have a favorite pair of side characters.
Please.
So I think one of my favorite pairs of side characters is from one of my favorite film franchises, which is The Lord of the Rings. And I really, really love Legolas and Gimli, because both of these two characters, the elf and the dwarf, they, in their own terms, serve as members of the Fellowship of the Ring, helping escort Frodo to Mordor. They give access to different different abilities and different things for the various groups to use. And they serve, as the story moves on, as sort of secondary characters to Aragorn once Aragorn breaks off and sort of moves on his own journey. And they become a really interesting pair that sort of sometimes serve as comedic relief, sometimes are really, really awesome, and other times are just helping move the plot forward. A lot of the time, Legolas's elf abilities, such as his elf eyes, as they're referred to, can see farther, hear farther, and allows them to sort of gain knowledge that they wouldn't otherwise have. But I mean, that was part of the problem researching this podcast. There are so many phenomenal examples of great supporting characters out there that it was really hard to narrow them down to try and pick like characters that were emblematic of the various various kinds, the various categories.
Yeah.
In addition to being involved in the world and having a purpose within the narrative, it's important that the supporting characters give depth to the protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
So using their purpose within the narrative, they need to further the protagonist somehow along their journey, along their character arc. Now, they can also have character arcs of their own. That totally happens. It happens a lot more in television than it does in movies, but it can still happen in movies. There are very few movies where supporting characters present through, 75% of the runtime and they don't change in some way. Again, Lord of the Rings is a phenomenal example of a way to trace this because you've got three movies laying out this plot as opposed to just one.
I think one of my favorite side characters that have like a very distinct arc and stuff alongside the main character would probably be Loki in the MCU.
Ooh, that's a very good
example. Has an incredibly interesting story arc and often acts as an antagonist, as a mm-hmm. best friend, as a mentee. Like, he kind of goes through a lot of different versions of, a lot of different categories from what you said of this kind of side character. And has kind of an arc all his own that mm-hmm. is separate and yet contributes to the arc of the main character of Thor, which is... I've always found to be really interesting.
That's a really good point. And it's interesting now that we're in the age of franchise films, like solidly in that era, it's really interesting that we can get much more fleshed out supporting characters because rather than having to dedicate huge chunks of a movie to developing the backstory of these secondary characters, we can actually just have bits and pieces contributing to their character development and their backstory movie by movie. So exactly, Loki's a great example of a character that has shifted dramatically from whenever the first Thor movie came out to Endgame. Mm-hmm. To Infinity War, where the Loki that we fell in love with was axed brutally. Spoiler alert.
Yikes.
It's just important to remember that your supporting characters are still characters, and that no matter how important your protagonist is, no matter how much of a lone wolf, no matter how much of an individual your protagonist is, if they've got friends, if they have an enemy, if they have anyone around them that spends time with them, that needs to be a person too. They need to have texture, they need to have flavor, they need to have personality.
I would agree.
What about those characters that don't spend a lot of time with the protagonist? What about those characters that don't spend a lot of time on screen at all?
About them?
Well, those are going to be our triagonists, like I mentioned earlier. We've got things such as minor characters, which are characters that can spend anywhere from 15 minutes to 10 minutes to 5 minutes on screen, and then something called a bit part, which is often referred to in the film industry here as under-fivers, because they often have 5 lines or less. So these characters, these bit parts, they are kind of the tiny little cogs in the machine that make sure everything keeps moving, but they too are very, very strongly involved in making a film or a narrative work because they are often the shopkeeper or the barmaid or the, guitarist that someone throws a dollar to on the street.
This is the set dressing I was speaking of earlier.
Yeah. These characters are the ones that, while the supporting characters really further the protagonist, these are often the ones where you really get to texture the world. So I'd love to double back to Men in Black really quickly, because I think it's a phenomenal example of having a whole bunch of colorful, highly detailed minor characters, at least physically, that really sort of inform the world you're in without them being particularly involved in the story of the antagonist. For instance, there's a scene where Will Smith has first walked in to Ellis Island for aliens, you know, and bumps into some aliens in the terminal, and they look at him all grumpy, and they just kind of this walk through this long hallway of all these aliens going through what is basically airport security or border patrol is a really, really great way to sort of build the world of Men in Black without having him sit down with Tommy Lee Jones and just being like, well, this is an airport, but for aliens now.
I think of earlier Pixar, it's less common now, but in early Pixar, I think there was a lot of examples of a world that was very different from how our world is, but in a really creative way. Like, I would think, like, the first Monsters, Inc. All of the monsters that you kind of see, like, at the beginning, kind of going about their usual business. I find that to be really interesting, kind of an example of this, and how, like, just in them doing what they do, not necessarily speaking or anything, as monsters tend to not do, how just them going about their day-to-day lives kind of fleshed out what the organization, like, what Monsters, Inc. was.
Yeah.
Even if you don't necessarily understand the entirety of the world that they lived in, you understood that organization for the movie.
Sure. And it's important to remember that, like, these minor characters and these bit parts can still stand out in a way that even if they only have those 5 minutes. A really great quote that I found from the early 2000s is from a gentleman named Dabs Greer, D-A-B-B-S-G-R-E-E-R, who passed away fairly recently, but he has over 100 film credits to his name and probably 150 or so television credits to his name, most of which are entirely actually uncredited. He's the a king of bit part actors, if you will, and he made his living doing these five-liners, these, you know, one-take wonders kind of thing. And his the quote is, every character actor in their own little sphere is the lead. And I think that's really, really interesting, because it's cool to think that, you know, this character with his one line is still vitally important to the story. And so that when that character speaks that one line, that's his moment. That is that character's moment. Or when a minor character has one or two appearances in the film, she can still take the show. A really, really great example, Shakespeare in Love, the film. Judi Dench plays Queen Elizabeth and is hilarious and, you know, very imposing and has this, like, crazy quality to the character, even though the character's on screen for maybe 4 or 5 minutes, I think, total. Hardly on screen at all, except for two major scenes towards the beginning of the film and then right at the end, where she sort of serves as a, you know, helps wrap up the plot. Not quite a deus ex machina, but that kind of thing. And Judi Dench ended up winning Best Supporting Actress for that role.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think Alex and I have mentioned it before, I don't know necessarily here, but that we used to do theater a lot, and Alex still does theater now, and we mentioned, one thing that we definitely learned, I think, pretty early on, like back in high school, was that even if your character, even if you're an ensemble part, even if your character doesn't say a single word, you should develop your own kind of story for your character. Your character should have a distinct personality. And I think in caring, and I think that's something that actors learn, that actors either should learn or they have learned.
Or if you are directing or producing a film, it's your job to make sure your actors know that.
Impart that on to them. Yeah, like, let them be, you know, as an actor, be creative. Say, okay, well, I'm going to make this whole circumstance for my character, and based on what I... and based on the reality I've created for my character, on the backstory I've created for them, even if it's not in the script, this is how I will react to this or that. And I think that's a really easy way to kind of add depth to your, even your characters who you would consider to be set dressing, quote unquote. And I feel like using, and I feel like saying set dressing sounds a little demeaning. I wish I had a better word.
No, but it is kind of accurate, because they're not, like all the aliens and TSA quote unquote agents in the in the Men in Black terminal. They're not, they're part of the set because they're not really directly interfacing with any of our characters. They're not related to the narrative in any way.
But set dressing is important.
Yeah, they're there to set the world up for us. So yeah, I think all of these things are super important. And then it's another thing that's important to keep in mind, especially this works especially well with the medium of film, is the main character does not always have to be the exact focus of the film. There are so many films, especially classic ones, but, you know, any kind of film, where oftentimes we start off with our protagonist, and then for a while we'll cut away to our villain, and the villain will be there twirling his mustache, explaining his plot to his henchmen, or to a captive woman, you know, those kind of things. And in that
case... Like Hades and Hercules.
That's a great example. Yeah. It's the opportunity to cut away to these secondary characters to help build the narrative more, or to give the audience more insight into what the protagonist is going to have to do. So like The Godfather is a great example. Of course we have our main character, we have The Godfather, we have Marlon Brando, but oftentimes we'll cut to numerous other characters and get their point of view for a while before we move on. Or The Usual Suspects, we actually get stories from several different points of view as Verbal Kent is describing the happenings surrounding Kaiser Soze. So we have a lot of interesting ways to utilize supporting actors beyond just putting them around our protagonist. But, you know, there's lots of different ways to flesh them out. Of course, you can make them as realistic as possible and just have them be real people. Oftentimes, though, especially if you have a dearth of characters, or if it's a minor character who's not on screen for very long, rather than writing them and fleshing them out similarly to a protagonist, you could instead sort of make them a stock character. Now, we're all familiar with stock characters. It's a basic writing thing. They're characters that fall into classic literary tropes, things like those five categories I mentioned earlier. You know, make them very obviously a mentor character, very obviously a fool, very obviously sort of like a posh rich person. You know, you oftentimes, because audiences are exposed to their culture's literature, you can show them a character, and within seconds, assuming it's a stock character, the audience will know exactly what that character is about. And so that's a really, really solid way to introduce minor characters to an audience without really having to actually introduce those characters.
Yeah, I would also say, though, that's a really great opportunity to take a stock character, quote unquote, and then use turning that on its head to create some surprises in a narrative. Like Bad Times at the El Royale, where we kind of get an idea of who the characters are at the beginning, and then pretty much every character is completely flipped, or we learn some kind of detail that we weren't expecting by the end.
It's a very, very good point, yeah. Subverting expectations is a great way to flesh out these characters. And there's so many, like I said, there are so many examples of great secondary characters. I mean, if just look at mine and Monica's favorite movies. Monica's favorite movie is Jurassic Park. And outside of Dr. Hugh Grant, we have, I mean, golly, everybody in that movie is extremely interesting. The first one that comes to mind is, of course, Jeff Goldblum, but who plays, you know, Dr. Ian Malcolm, and he's unbelievably interesting. But you've got all kinds of people in that one. Samuel Jackson's in it as well, and he's great Newman from Seinfeld. Yeah. And they all play these, like, interesting supporting characters that are critical to the plot, and some of which are heavily involved with our protagonists. And then my favorite movie is The Grand Budapest Hotel, which, kind of on the opposite spectrum from Jurassic Park, rather than a core cast of a lot of strong supporting characters, you have a couple of main characters, and then just tons and tons of people who are on screen for, you know, minutes at a time. I mean, Jeff Goldblum is in that one too, but rather than being on screen almost as much as our protagonist, Jeff Goldblum is on screen for maybe 10 minutes max before he's brutally murdered inside of a museum. Like, there's all kinds of characters in there, but they don't have long to be established outside of their dialogue, but they still do a good job of furthering the narrative for our protagonists.
It's very lucky that our favorite films are two examples of opposite ends of the spectrum.
And also two films involving Jeff Goldblum.
You know, he's prolific.
He is. He's very prolific. And he's great at playing those characters, which kind of brings me to, I think, the third point about supporting characters beyond developing deuteragonists and developing triagonists, is that oftentimes it is as much the actor's job to make a character stand out as it is the writer's job.
Totally.
And so that is another thing that we have to consider as filmmakers is, you know, who are we putting in this person's shoes? Because oftentimes a very exciting actor can make even the most mundane lines interesting. But yeah. On the flip side of that, you know, even the most exciting dialogue can be completely ruined by an uninspired performance.
I also think it's interesting when you have a character and maybe it was imagined or written one way, but if you add someone who kind of isn't what you would have expected, like in Alien, how all of the parts are written to be played by anyone, not necessarily a man, not necessarily a woman, and that created, you know, a cast of characters that felt very... I don't know. I just think it's interesting that a character who normally you would have, if it had been read by, say, a white man, it would have read differently than having mm-hmm. a woman play the role.
Or yeah, that's fair.
Different than a black man playing the role. And mm-hmm. simply not because of how the actor plays it necessarily or how it's written necessarily, but in what ends up being the visual representation, you know, put on top of what people kind of expect.
Sure, yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, yeah, it absolutely does. And all of these are different things that we have to keep in mind and we have to use. And I think what I wanted to kind of dive into at the end here to really kind of drive home just how... you know, strange and pivotal, is that the word? Pivotal. Yeah, that is a word.
That is a word.
Lord of mercy. Yeah. How pivotal these characters can be and how important they can be is I did want to go over one bit part, one of my favorite bit parts of all time, which is Miracle, in the movie Miracle on 34th Street, which is, of course, a Christmas movie where a gentleman is claiming to be Santa Claus and he is being sued for claiming to be Santa Claus, and basically he has to prove to the court that he is Santa Claus. One of the little girls in the movie sends him a letter addressed to Santa Claus at the courthouse. And there's a mail sorter played by a gentleman named, Jack Albertson. And this mail sorter gets the letter addressed to the courthouse, addressed to Santa Claus, and says, well, hey, why don't we just send all of our, you know, Santa Claus mail addressed to the North Pole, send it there, because Lord knows, we don't know where to put it. We don't know what to do with it. So they send all of their excess Christmas mail to the courthouse, and that helps convince the court that maybe this guy really is Santa Claus. Hmm. And it gets the case resolved and everything. But, you know, beyond that, what I really wanted to dive into is I want to look at a couple of examples from the filmography of a pair of directors who, they're oftentimes, when you watch their movies, their minor characters, their supporting characters, are infinitely more interesting than their leading men. And that is the Coen brothers.
Would you say that's an intentional choice?
I think it is definitely an intentional stylistic choice. A lot of if you've ever seen the casting calls for some of their movies, for some of these like bit parts, they often ask for specifically normal or odd looking people. So they want people who don't look like movie actors, and it shows. They have a lot of people in their films who stand out as very, very different, some of which are famous actors, but others of which, you know, aren't. Especially in their early films, a lot of these bit parts are filled by people that you have never seen before. And then often in their later films, actually, they've found a lot of success in taking really important actors or A-listers and putting them into these bit parts. I mean, in Hail Caesar, one of their more recent films, Jonah Hill is in it, mm-hmm. and he's on screen for a minute. 60 seconds.
Yeah. Or the recent, what was on Netflix?
The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah. With it all being kind of like short narratives. Mm-hmm. They had...
Gosh. You could be thinking of anybody. I mean, they had James Franco.
James Franco. I was thinking of.
Yeah, and James Franco plays.
And he, like, dies. And
yeah. I think Ballad of Buster Scruggs is really interesting because, to me, that feels like sort of a culmination of all of the work they've done to have all of these really bizarre minor characters. So, like, I mean, just to name a few, we've got in Javier Bardem as Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men, the, you know, psychopath mercenary with the cow murdering nail gun thing. Crazy stuff. And he does the, you know, the famous what's the most you've ever lost on a coin toss scene. We've got Domhnall Gleeson, who plays Hux in the new Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. He plays the character Moon, or the kid in True Grit, who is just this bizarre character. Really, really interesting to watch. or one of my favorites, and one of everyone's favorites, I think, John Turturro's Jesus in The Big Lebowski, which, not on screen for very long, classic. But definitely like the first thing we see in that movie, and definitely sets the tone for the insanity to follow. But I'd love to look at specifically Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, because Oh Brother, Where Art Thou,
love,
is phenomenal.
Heart eyes emoji.
And it really lends itself to these secondary characters because it's based on the old, the Odyssey, Homer's The Odyssey, the Greek legend. And the interesting thing about The Odyssey is it involves Odysseus moving from place to place, encountering all of these trials on his way back to his wife from the Trojan War. And so that really lends itself to these almost episodic vignettes of them running into all sorts of crazy characters. And even the main party, the two supporting characters, John Turturro as Pete and Tim Blake Nelson as Delmar, are infinitely more interesting than George Clooney's character because they're just crazy. But then, I mean, we run into John Goodman as Big Dan Teague, the Cyclops Bible salesman. Mm. You have Holly Hunter playing George Clooney's wife, Penny, and she talks in that high-pitched, you know, I don't know, you're going to have to bring me that ring, you know, that kind of voice. Ray McKinnon plays Penny's new fiancé, Vernon Waldrop, and he's like this poppy, you know, he's got the long, wide-brimmed straw hat, and he's like this poppy, you know, kind of guy. Or, you know, one of the standout performances in that whole film is Michael Badalucho's baby face, George Nelson, the gangster. I mean, everybody loves that part. And he's on screen for all of like 6 minutes, I think.
Right.
You know, and all of these parts come together to make a movie that is unbelievably memorable and unbelievably strange, but also, you know, they provide a texture to the world that really kind of counters George Clooney's charming straight man.
Right. I think that's, it's really great to have interesting side characters when you have a quote-unquote, like, perfect, charming, whatever, like, main character. Mm-hmm. If your main character is exactly what the expectation is for the world you're building or whatever, it can be very dull.
Yeah.
I mean, naturally, your main character should have some sort of change, but that doesn't necessarily mean they aren't already, you know, what is expected for that character. And I think side characters are a fun way to challenge that character or add some, I suppose, light to a story, or something fresh to a story.
And, you know, it works even if it's not like a bright individual like George Clooney, because in their film Inside Llewyn Davis, Oscar Isaac plays the main character, and he's very, you know, sullen, very dark, and the characters around him still light everything up. They light up the whole stage. And it's just, it's so interesting to see all of these characters that completely flip the script on everything, and really, and when they're on screen, they completely take your attention away from the narrative, but in a way that's not, not in a bad way, not in a way that ruins the film, in a way that sort of accentuates what you want to do with your narrative.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in short, I think supporting characters are more important than the main character.
Yeah, I think they definitely should not be ignored as a piece, as a narrative device.
Agreed.
For sure. They are a narrative device, and an important one.
Very important one. So,
and one that can be really interesting and add a lot of depth to your story or add humor to your story. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I think, look down on the concept of like a comedic relief character or something like that. But those characters exist because they are important. Especially if you have a really intense story, you probably do need that to cut it a little bit.
And, you know, I think what's really interesting is even talking about, like, especially with these the deuteragonists that I was talking about that have such secondary importance and are still in a grand majority of the narrative, it's oftentimes hard to sometimes even tell the difference between the two. And oftentimes a supporting character, the interestingness, quote-unquote, of a supporting character will surpass the protagonist. I mean, Star Wars is a great example. We all love Luke Skywalker, but, like, Darth Vader's way more interesting.
I would say Leia is more interesting.
Leia's more interesting, sure. Han Solo's probably more interesting. Everyone's more interesting than little white bread Mark Hamill. I'm just kidding. I love you, Mark.
I love Luke Skywalker.
No, yeah, and he's a great character, but compared to the world around him, he's boring.
Yeah, I was about to say, if there were no other characters, though, to enjoy, he would be, like, probably too much. Like, he would be maybe too perfect or yeah. too...
I don't know. The supporting characters need to add depth and oftentimes add foil to our protagonist, you know? So yeah, I think it's important to keep those in mind. And next time you go out and watch a movie, you know, keep an eye on the background.
Pay attention to the supporting characters. Somebody's working hard to make them.
Yeah, exactly. And if you want to hear more about supporting characters in various films that come out throughout the year, Monica, did you know that we do another podcast?
We do?
Yeah, we do.
I hadn't noticed even a little bit.
Monica
no, it's
and I...
true. We have our own podcast.
Yes, it's called Shot for Shot.
It is, and you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or on Podbean.com, and that's Shot for Shot Podcast. You could just search Shot for Shot, and we should pop up.
You can also find us on our own website at www.shotforshotcast.com.
That is true.
You can find us on Twitter at Shot for Shot Cast 18. You can find us on Instagram at Shot for Shot Cast and on Facebook at Shot for Shot Podcast, right?
It's just Shot for Shot Podcast.
Yeah. So you can find us at all those different places. And then you can also find us pretty much monthly here at Mirror Box Films.
Yeah. Roughly monthly.
Roughly monthly. And, you know, we'll keep turning out good content for you, whether it's film theory, whether we're geeking out about a new movie, or, you know, whatever we're doing. Please feel free to keep in touch and follow along.
And we do so love to work with Mirror Box and create these podcasts. So big thanks to them. If you liked this particular episode, make sure that you review the Mirror Box podcast and let us know on any of Mirror Box's platforms, and that's Mirror Box Films on all platforms. You can find us. Let us know on any of those platforms who your favorite side characters are.
Yeah.
If you have some side characters that absolutely captured your attention more than the main character, we'd love to hear about it.
And with that, I think we're going to go ahead and sign off. So you guys have a wonderful day.
Goodbye.
Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed listening to Alex and Monica for a bit.
Welcome back. We are a lot less drunk than Monica was in that episode.
Surprisingly, since, you know,
surprisingly,
just...
this one time. What'd you think, Sonia? What'd you think of this episode?
I thought it was swell.
Yeah, I had never heard these terms deuterogonist or tritagonist. I had never heard those terms before. I never went to college. I never went to college for theater or anything like that. And so I felt like I learned a lot.
Yes, as did I. I have also not heard those terms, and I also didn't go to college for theater, so... Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things that I loved about this episode was just looking at kind of underserved people in the world. I'm kind of a guy who, like, always pulls for the underdog, right? So there's a certain joy in celebrating the small. And so I especially loved the... Gosh, I'm not going to remember the actor's name, but the actor they talked about that had been in, like, 200, like, bit parts. Like, that's the kind of guy, like, I love celebrating in life. And so what did you get out of this episode? What are kind of takeaways that people can take and apply in their own lives as they celebrate the small?
Oh, I mean, everybody in everyone's life serves a purpose, you know? Even though we kind of feel in our own lives, we are the center of our stories, we are the center of the universe. Even though we feel that way in our own lives, if you're, you know, super narcissistic and whatnot, you're still...
I am.
You're still playing a supporting role in somebody else's life, hopefully. You know, whether that is your friends, your family, whether that's the person that you're walking by on the street and you hold a door open for them, or you like flash them a smile, you know.
What are you gonna flash them?
or you just flash them. I mean, like, that also plays a key part in their life. You could start traumatizing them and cause them to go to therapy, spend thousands of dollars, you know. It's the butterfly effect.
I feel like in today's society, it's so easy to feel small. So, like, you only need to be on social media for 1 second before you start to feel smaller than everybody else.
That's
that you
true.
Don't have the chances that other people do. that you don't have the success other people do. You don't have the vacation homes that other people do, right? And especially in the creative arts. So as filmmakers, we're constantly comparing ourselves to other people. And even on set, you're comparing yourself to the other people on set. You know, there's kind of a pecking order, like the actor or the director is more important. And let's say you're doing a job where you're doing, you know, craft services, or you're an extra and that you feel like the small person on the totem pole. But the thing about a film set especially is it's such a creative and collaborative environment that every person on set really serves a role. Would you say that's accurate?
I would, because think about any movie that you've watched and any group scene. I mean, think about like Legally Blonde and all of those scenes where she's in like a giant classroom setting. If they only had like the main actors in that, then that's a large empty classroom.
That because, would be unrealistic.
Yeah, like you need the background actors for all those kinds of scenes. And you know,
and you need the background actors to disappear in a certain way. Like if the background actor was shining a spotlight and being goofy, then that would take the...
Exactly.
The power from the scene away. So that really everybody does serve a purpose. And I think that's important in real life too, that it's so easy to get to feel like we're just lost and to feel like we're less than because we haven't reached some sort of goal of where we want to be. But I think a lot of power for us as creatives, when we're feeling small, we can take that power back by creating. By making something from nothing, by collaborating with other talented people.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts about doing a lot of background stuff on sets, is that you meet people that are trying to climb that ladder in all different roles, you know, whether it is that they want to move on to being a PA so that they can join the DGA, or whether they want to be an actor, or they want to be writers or producers, you know, all that stuff. You're meeting all those people while they are at the bottom, and potentially you're finding people that you can hopefully collaborate with, as long as, you know, you can trust that everyone can share within the same vision and are responsible people. You know, there are definitely background actors that are there just because it's an easy way to get a paycheck and they don't care about anything else and they don't treat it like a real job.
Yeah. But
those are the people that, you know, you try to avoid on those kinds of sets.
And the thing is, you never know too who, you know, today's PA is tomorrow's, you know, director. So you like, be cool. Be cool to people, no matter what they're doing.
Always say thank you, you know.
Yeah.
Just be a positive light in everyone else's world, you know. Aww. That can be your supporting bit.
Inspirational. Put that on a bumper sticker. The other key takeaway that I took is, as a writer and you're writing small roles, put on an actor's hat and kind of ask yourself, if I were an actor, would I want to play this role? And if the answer is no, then maybe you can flesh out that character a little better. Like, I think oftentimes we just put, I need somebody to say a line here. Well, like, think a minute and revisit that a little bit. How can you make that person that says a line a little bit more interesting, a little bit more important, a little bit more supporting thematically or emotional or to the main character?
Mm-hmm. And I think something too in real life that can help you with that is take an acting class or an improv class or something like that. Ooh. You know, put yourself out there so that you're aware generally of what it is that actors are kind of looking for within a script. Because you'll hear a lot of the times too that bigger, like blockbuster actors, they'll still take independent film roles because they fell in love with the script. And so you wanna be sure to be writing your script in a way that
that
everyone's going to fall in love with it. Everyone's going to want to be a part of that project, whether they have 4 lines or they have 500.
1 million lines.
Or 1 million. That's a long script. You should probably cut it down. But, you know, to each their own, I guess.
Yeah. All right, that's it for us today, you guys. Thank you for listening. Sonia, where can people find out about us online?
On the interwebs, you can check us out at mirrorboxfilms.com. It's where we host our blog. You can find links to the rest of our podcasts, some cool video stuff, you know, all that jazz.
Yep. Or find us online on social media at mirrorboxfilms on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. That's it. We'll see you next week.
Peace out.